everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Bowden. With me, the Ambler Rambler, Mr. Pennsylvania, Barry Rose. Today, we have an episode where, dare I say, Barry, we're going to stick to wrestling. Would you agree?
Oh, stick to wrestling. Jeff, that's a great name for a podcast, actually.
That's what I thought about, and I think somebody else glommed in on it, but, I'm not going to mention any names. So on today's episode, because of that, we are primarily going to be dealing with wrestling today. No movie of the week, no Florida Man, nothing like that. For a couple of reasons, and I'll go into them. Number one, we're going to spend some time with my co-host Barry Rose discussing his friendship over many, many, many years with the late soul man Rocky Johnson, who we lost recently. And Barry's going to offer his thoughts and views on the passing of his dear friend Rocky. We are going to play part three. Part three, Barry. We got three parts out of Jimmy Garvin, and this is really good stuff as Jimmy talks about his time in the AWA with Vern, his feud with Rick Martel, coming down to Crockett, and he's going to talk about that, and then reuniting with Michael Hayes as part of the Freebirds. And finally, we're going to wrap up the show with a review of one of Jimmy's matches, as it's Jimmy and Barry Windham post-Ronnie Garvin angle with the Midnight Express. And oh, I forgot to mention, Jimmy offers some really interesting, Barry, I think you'll agree with me, some interesting viewpoints on his relationship with Ronnie Garvin at the top of the interview. That was some good stuff, Bear.
It really was some good stuff. And we're so grateful that, and I reached out to Jimmy just to thank him. But Jimmy gave us over 3 hours of his life over the last couple of weeks. And, just to sit here, just to be able to talk about his career. And I think part of the beauty of when you listen to wrestling interviews, if it's a good interview, and I think this is a good interview, and not because of you and I, though you were great in this, Jeff, but it's the subject. And Jimmy was really honest and open. But how much did we walk away from this interview that is brand new for us, stuff that we did not know, that we had never learned before? So I'm super appreciative. But Jim, here's the question, Jeff, can we ever top this?
That's gonna be tough, man. This is he's kind of set a new bar for us, I think, at this point. And one of the things, like you pointed out, that I appreciated this from Jim, is that there was stuff that he did in his career that he really said, oh, wow, this is really good stuff. I really enjoyed this, or this guy was a pleasure to work for. Then we had one particular angle that he was involved with that he kind of said it was really not a big deal to me. It didn't really, I didn't really think it was that great, which I thought was very interesting, because it's something that we're going to bring up in our match of the week. So before we get to that, I want to and before we get to the subject matter of today, I do want to mention, Barry, I happened to take a look this morning, and I wanted to mention the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry Facebook group. Now up, Barry, 1,556. We're heading to 1,600. All those other Facebook groups that are on the Arcadian Network, you can suck it, because outside of the 605, we are the leader, baby. You're just looking at our fumes. Barry, that they might be all the want to be ever. Us, but they can't. So suck it. Now, on that
Love
note,
it.
I'm going to get some fucking heat for that, I know. Barry, let's get a little more serious here for a second. I was just having
All right. We got to switch gears. Is that
yes,
what
we do.
Yeah, we're going to switch gears. All right.
Going from first to fourth here. So, all right. Let's get a little serious. We, unfortunately, as has been reported in many, many, many other sites, and finally, Barry, I know, confirmed by the WWE, because it really apparently didn't happen unless it was confirmed by the WWE. We lost Rocky Johnson, a man that was very important in your life, in your personal life, and your life as a wrestling fan. And I know you wanted to share with the listeners of this podcast, the listeners, your friends, and people, your thoughts on the passing of Rocky Johnson.
Yeah, so it was, and I put this out there too. I don't know if it wasn't for Rocky's kindness to my father and myself, if I would have become as obsessed with not just professional wrestling, which obviously to some degree we all are, but my obsession with CWF and archiving the history and trying to preserve the history of that promotion. And it really was Rocky's kindness towards me when I was a kid and as an adult that really helped, foster that obsession with it. I first met Rocky, it was, I guess it was 1975, and I was 11 years old. I was a kid, you know, I had full head of hair, and I think I was a size, you know, I had a real skinny waist. Life was good back in those days, and I never knew the relationship with my father and Rocky Johnson, or how it began, until Rocky told me just 4 or 5 years ago how it began. And as I read his autobiography, the book that he put out with Scott Teal, which is obviously generating a lot of controversy lately, there is a story in there where Rocky talks about it. And apparently my father went up to him one night and said, "My son really wants to meet you. You're his favorite wrestler." And Rocky had some sort of response. "Well, I'm a lot of kids' favorite wrestlers." And I don't know what else they talked about, but they became friendly and they became friends. And my dad was the regional vice president of Levitt's, the old Levitt's Furniture Corporation, which was national, but really in the South, it was a big furniture corporation.
You'll maybe love it at Levitt's.
You will love it at Levitt's. And it was a really big deal in the 60s and 70s into the 80s. I don't think there's any left. There might be, but I'm not aware of it. And that business obviously has changed. But my dad would get some of the wrestlers, I guess the ones he was friendly with, he would get them furniture at cost. So the wrestlers were always good to him. By default, they were good to me then as well, and they were getting furniture at cost, and it always worked out. So I got to know Rocky at a young age. He was never anything but great with me. You know, certainly he wasn't a perfect man. There are stories that are out there, and you know, I don't know who of us are perfect. But that being said, his legacy in professional wrestling it's a big hole. And you know, there's an overused cliche about breaking down barriers and things like that. But, you know, I think there are a handful of wrestlers that it honestly and truly you could apply that cliche to. I think a guy like Sputnik Monroe, who has been discussed at great lengths of, you know, what he did with the civil rights movement and his support of African-Americans, and Sweet Daddy Siki. But Rocky Johnson as well. Rocky Johnson, Jeff, the first black Florida heavyweight champion, the first black Georgia heavyweight champion. And when you go back to, let's say, 1974 into 75, when he was the Georgia heavyweight champion, you go into some of these smaller towns. Get outside of Atlanta. Look, and Atlanta had its issues back then as well. But you get into some of these, you know, smaller towns. This is deep south as you can possibly get. And even the state of Florida, you know, you and I spent so much time in Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, I don't know how old I was, you know, the first time I realized that not the entire state of Florida was like Miami Beach, that if I go, you know, if I go north.
Suffice to say, there are two different parts of the state of Florida.
Oh, absolutely. Even to this day, there are, but especially back in the mid 70s. So the fact that promotions and promoters and the owners of the promotions had confidence in Rocky Johnson to make him the champion. And that was based off of, you know, a couple of things. One was he had an undeniable amount of charisma. He was a very good wrestler when he was motivated. When he was on his game, he was really, really good, but he was putting butts in seats. And ultimately, that's what it's always going to be about. So he was a favorite of Eddie Graham. You know, he came in multiple times. Every time he came in, they were giving him titles, whether it was Florida title or TV title or tag team titles. He was multi-time tag team champion. The same with Georgia, but even in a place like Tennessee, you know, in Memphis, he was a champion in Memphis. And, you know, Texas, everywhere he went, he was put on top, and there was a reason for it. So from a wrestling perspective, it was a huge loss. Apparently, he did die of a blood clot, which was something that I just found out, but had a blood clot in his leg that then traveled, and he passed away. So at 75 years old, you and I saw him, Jeff, just a couple of months ago in you know, November at the Fan Fest in Florida. We were able to spend some time with him, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful that we were able to do that.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I was able to buy the book from Rocky, and I was able to get it signed, which really meant a lot. He set and posed, did the chin pose with me, and I posted that in our Facebook group, and that, you know, in retrospect, yeah, again, Barry constantly, mentions that when you get an opportunity to go to one of these fan fests, not just the CWF Legends Fan Fest, any fan fest where you get an opportunity to meet someone who was the hero of your youth. Don't pass this up, because, you know, who's to say that these guys are going to be here, you know, here in November? Who could have predicted that, you know, that 2 months later we would have already lost Rocky? And needless to say, it has not been a good start to 2020, Barry. I can just point that out, because.
Yeah, it really has been terrible. And Bobby Kay passed away. Yeah, there's a guy, I know he spent time in West Texas, in Amarillo, certainly wrestled all throughout Canada. I think he may have spent time in the Kansas City promotion. I'm not a positive of that. And then there were some guys that weren't as well known, guys that were working on the independent scene. And I believe we lost two in the last week. So it's been a terrible start. And to your point, Jeff, and I think we're saying it every episode, meet your heroes, meet your idols, wrestling, movies, TV, whatever it is, you know, music, if you've idolized or even appreciated, maybe that's a better word. If you've had an appreciation for something, and to the point, you know, that you would want to meet somebody, don't pass up the opportunity. And the other aspect of that is, you know, and I think we've done a really, really good job of this. I know in my CWF group, we don't take shots at anybody, but tearing people down, it doesn't benefit anybody in any form. And even in the CWF group, I call it a respect group, because, look, there are certain guys that came through that may not have been the best wrestler. Maybe they were terrible. Ali Pasha is probably a really good example. But the idea is, you know, we don't want to tear these people down. We don't want to do it. So, you know, give respect where respect is deserved. But at the same time, you know, meet your heroes, meet the people you appreciate, whether it's real life or not. You know, I'm going to Boston when this episode drops on Tuesday. I'll be going to Boston in just a few days after that. And my goal is I want to meet up with Benji, possibly Antonio might be coming, Josh Dunn, Mark Beaudry. So there's several of our listeners that, you know, I'm hopeful I can go out and maybe grab a meal with while I'm there. Meet the people you communicate with, meet the people you like, whether it is, again, you know, entertainment or not.
Well, I'm going to encourage you also to reach out to Sean Goodwin, but McAdam, you need to not call that guy. Let him be the one that wasn't invited. But I'm just kidding. Just getting back to Rocky, the one thing you didn't mention, you talked about some of the territories he worked in. You're absolutely right about that. But you did not mention he was a huge deal on the West Coast. San Francisco for Roy Shire. He did spots in L.A. for LaBelle. He was a guy that literally worked almost every territory you can think of, with the possible exception of the AWA. And we may have our suspicions as to why that didn't happen. But a guy, you know, we recently had the Hall of Fame discussion a few episodes back. And you know, Rocky was a guy that, you know, some people are like, well, I don't know if he's a Hall of Famer or not. And you know, I'm sorry, when you headline that many territories, how can you deny that somebody was a Hall of Famer? And what happens is you have people nowadays that, you know, not to sound like the old man on the lawn here, but you have people that have a different perspective on what wrestling is than what it used to be, you know. And Rocky Johnson was a absolute Hall of Famer. And let me just point out and mention, if you have not had a chance, and I know Bobby Van Kevlar mentioned or posted in our group the message that his son Dwayne posted on Instagram about his father. And oh my God, it's absolutely gut-wrenching to read it, but it's so heartfelt and, you know, it was so beautifully written. And, you know, big thumbs up to Dwayne for the job that he did writing that heartfelt message to his father, because you could really see the love he had for his father, while at the same time mentioning, as Barry said, that his father wasn't an angel, you know, and he came to realize that, but he also, you know, still loved and respected his father. It was a beautifully and well-written, and, you know, I can only hope that when my time comes that someone cares enough about me to write something even close to that, Barry.
Well, Jeff, I will volunteer to write your obituary for you. And Jeff, I'm going to lead it off on the day you die, Jeff. I'm going to lead it off with, Jeff, you were 100% correct.
Thank you.
So I think that would be absolutely.
And,
but no,
and then say, but I digress.
But I digress.
That was finale.
That That being said, yeah, when I would run through all the cliches that you and I do, but I would agree with you. Look at you know, Rocky, there, you know, there are things that would make him less than perfect. It's out there. There's no reason to dispute. But like everybody, mistakes were made, you know, whether you forgive or not, that's entirely up to you. But with that, and that being said, Jeff, Dwayne was his son, and I can tell you, having met Dwayne multiple times when he was a kid, he loved his father. He idolized him. He was, you know, I think I said this to you, he was Superman and God rolled up into one for him. And as Dwayne got older, he was aware of that his dad wasn't perfect. But at the same time, it was his dad, and he always viewed him that way. So from my perspective, you know, Rocky was somebody that was really, really good to me. Doesn't mean that, you know, again, that, you know, mistakes weren't made that I was aware of. But at the same time, you know, he was my friend.
Yeah. So we offer an adult beverage to the memory of Rocky Soul Man Johnson. And now, Barry, it's time for us to finish up our interview with Jimmy Garvin. Again, many, many thanks to Jim for giving us his time and discussing his career with us. So now to our producer, Sweet Lou Kippelman, let's go to part three, the final part of our interview with gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Okay, Jim, so we left off the last part of the interview with your relationship, past, present, future, with Ron Garvin. Tell us about the relationship you had with Ron Garvin.
You know, as I think I mentioned before, not to repeat myself, but just to recap it, you know, my dad died when I was 12. He was the captain of the Temple Police Department. And then with all the wrestlers that stayed at the apartment, including, I think I mentioned them before too, Joe Scarpa, John Studd, Bruiser Brody, Jake the Snake, Angelo Mosca, and maybe Malenko for a little while early on. But my mom had, you know, met Mary Scarpa because she lived there, and they would run around. And I think May Young was around that time, and whoever was working with her and the group of girls at that time. So she was in the wrestling group as far as the wives and stuff like that. So she met Ronnie, and that I was about 14, 2 years after my dad passed. And then we would go to, Ronnie would take us all meaning my sister and one of my brothers, and we'd go to, the other one wasn't born yet, and then we'd go to Canada, and he would work for Kazabowski, and I would just mess around because I had needed something to do. They were up there all summer, so I set up the ring and sold tickets and, you know, made popcorn and did whatever they need a gopher does, but did that, and then did the same. Then we came back to Charlotte, went to school here for a while. I was 68. We went back up there, same thing. 69, we went back up there, and I stayed. That's when I met my wife, and I didn't mind staying because, you know, Ronnie was, he was okay, but he was 8 years older than me, so that would have put him, like, in his early 20s. And, you know, I could see the reasons for him doing that. I mean, we were financially, you know, had a nice home, and he didn't, and we had, you know, had a nice, we always drove a nice car and had a Cadillac, and he didn't, and, you know, so he kind of seen that, so whatever, you know, I, that's just my opinion. But that's, you know, they ended up getting married, and, you know, it was a, you know, he wasn't a father's knows best, that's for sure. Not really a great relationship at all, kind of put up with each other. And then finally when I went up there in 69, I just said, well, I'm just going to leave. And I think I was 17 or something like that, 16, 17, I can't exactly remember. But ended up leaving. And I believe I was 16, going to turn 17 or something, because November 1st of 69 is when I went to Phoenix, Arizona. Terry got me a spot down there, and he went down there, and I managed him. We actually went in as the Hines brothers, because the Hines brothers were supposed to come in, but something came up, and they didn't make it, so we took their spot and their name and everything. It was kind of a real jabroni kind of setup, but, I mean, that was, you know, you have to start somewhere, and that was certainly at the bottom, and that's certainly where we were. And then went from there to Alabama, and, you know, Ronnie continued doing his thing, whatever he did. And then as a team, Terry and Ronnie hooked up, I think, in Nashville sometime in 73, and then went to Atlanta in 74. Definitely those dates are good because I remember those. And at the same time, you know, his relationship and mine were, a non-working relationship as far as we went to work together and did what I was supposed to do, but nothing great. You know, I mean, I didn't miss him when he was gone, and he didn't miss me, so that was okay. We kind of understood that. So, you know, then years went on, and, you know, my mom and Ronnie ended up getting a divorce. And then, you know, he got married and did his thing. And I think my mom married a couple more times. She got kind of the Elizabeth Taylor part in her, you know. So that didn't matter because I was away from home anyway. I'm, you know, making my own way when I was pretty young. And so that would be that period. And then we ended up in Montreal doing that thing with the Rougeaus one summer. And that was just because Patty was from Canada in North Bay, so we could go see her mom, visit up there, and at the same time, we liked to camp. So we had the Samoans, Alpha and Sika, and Big Sam, and all of them. They liked to camp, too, so we did a lot of camping together, the Samoans and myself and my wife and my family and stuff. I think that was 85 or so, the summer of 85. And then after that, I think I went to Minnesota. Well, I think Minnesota, something like that. And then 86, I came to Charlotte. And I haven't seen Ronnie for, I don't know, 20 years or more. He was at a show that I was at in Winston-Salem. They just had a convention a couple of months ago. And I was at that. And Michael Hayes and I were together at that doing a signing. And he was there, and I never seen him, to be honest with you, never looked for him, and he never looked for me. So there really, you know, really was not a relationship to speak of. I mean, he's, you know, I hope he's all right. Good, you know, and hope he lives a long time, and good for him. And I heard he lives up in West Virginia or something like that in the mountains and goes hunting and shoots stuff and really and truly just no connection whatsoever, you know, and we probably won't see each other ever again, you know, because I'm, you know, that's just the way it was. So not a real good relationship if you was to judge it from one being really great and 10 being really kind of crappy. It was probably like a 9.5, you know, so no harm, no foul, because I was man enough and mature enough to, you know, take it and leave type stuff. And I didn't waste my time with stuff that wasn't worth my time. So that's kind of how I looked at that, you know, in a nutshell. he didn't impress me that much, you know?
Gotcha. So I want to back up just a little bit, and certainly we've been treating, at least attempting to do the interview in chronological order. But the one thing I want to bring up today, as we are recording, this is the 41st anniversary of the Joe LeDuc heel turn. And I know that we mentioned in the first part, a lot of people that grew up in the state of Florida, especially in the 70s, they view that heel turn as one of the greatest, if not the greatest of all time. So it is just a coincidence. But as I was looking through social media the last couple of days, I saw some photos when you were managing Terry Garvin and Duke Myers. And I believe this was for McGurk. Out yeah. In tri-states. So Duke Myers is an interesting guy. What was he like?
It was for Bill Watts in the Oklahoma area that we got hooked up with Duke Myers, and he was an okay guy. You know, is he still alive? Do you know?
No, he's not. He passed away a couple of years ago.
Okay. Well, you know, he was a hard worker, and you know, him and Terry did a good job, obviously, and I had no trouble working with him. He had a nice wife, and I respected him, and he respected me, and he was a big guy, and I can still picture him. And, you know, we never like were real super close, but he was okay guy.
So, okay. You left off, Jimmy, with talking about you were getting ready to go to the AWA, and a lot of what people remember about your time in the AWA, you had a really good program with Rick Martel. So,
absolutely.
Discuss your time in the AWA. First of all, your remembrances of your program with Martel and thoughts about working for Vern. And also, you know, at a certain point, the AWA started that inevitable slide. Mm-hmm. Did you see cracks in the foundation of Vern's promotion there, or was it still going strong in your eyes? So let's start off first with Martel. How'd you like working with Martel, and what'd you think of that program?
fantastic. I enjoyed it, and glad I got to experience it. He's a class act, a number one guy, a great worker, a gentleman. And if you could have a chance to work with somebody like that, it's really an honor to have somebody that has the talent that he has and the personality that he has. And it was just perfect. That was a great angle. I could see, because I messed around with Von Rasky a little bit on a couple of matches, but the big one, of course, was Martel. And we had a lot of fun, and we did well for him, because they needed help then, because by that time, Jesse Ventura had jumped the wall, and Hulk Hogan jumped, and Bobby Heenan and all them jumped, meaning going to WWF. And Vern was getting older, and I guess, he had never had to deal with the issue of, losing that kind of talent, more or less in a short period of time. So luckily, the Road Warriors came in, and that, of course, created a lot of energy in the territory. And then the fact that Martel and I were running hard together, that created energy. And the rest of the guys were pulling their load. So we were doing okay. I don't think he was losing money, but you could see that a chink off the armor had, it fell off and it wasn't exactly the same. So, it did take a bit of a slide. And then, of course, when we left in 85, then it proceeded to go ahead and slide on down, But I was there and it was still good. Kern was up there and, there was a good group of talent up there, but it was coming to the end of the chapter for the AWA, so to speak. But we had probably the last hurrah, with Scott Hall was breaking in at that time. I remember I worked with him in Vegas, had a good match, and was going to try and drop the title that I had, whichever one it was, to him. And, Vern's Vern, he was just slowly turning nuts, type of thing, but yeah, it was okay. Greg was trying to do his best to hold it together, and everybody was, trying to ball pulling in the same direction. But, I seen it, and the Road Warriors at the same time. Remember, they dropped the belts to me and Regal, the most unlikely of tag teams to take the belts off the Road Warriors. But I think it was punishment for them, and in some regard, by Vern, just to let them know, how it worked and how it was going to work, because I can't see any reason other than it's completely, you would never bet on that horse to win, me and Regal taking the titles from the Road Warriors.
Are you saying, Jim, that you and Steve Regal are not in the pantheon of all-time great tag teams?
No, we're well, no, we had fun on the road and, did what we were supposed to do, and it was just like, well, whatever. And luckily, both the Road Warriors liked us a lot, so if they were going to drop, that was probably one of the things. They probably wouldn't have done it, but because it was Steve and I, they probably thought, well, shoot, why not? They liked us. If they wouldn't have liked us, they probably wouldn't have done it, or it would have been a real difficult match, and it wasn't,
Yeah. Real quickly, so getting back to Vern. Going based on all the different promoters you worked for over your career, worst to best, where do you put Vern in there?
They all go in the same bucket. I'm totally honest, right? Because I don't pull no punches unless I'm in the ring. And then that's just because that's what you do. But I thought about this because I thought about that's a good question for somebody to ask me, because I am so honest and open with most everything, because it's like when we had the Hall of Fame Michael Knight 2016 in Orlando or wherever it was, I think Orlando, he said something and I said, well, I really don't care what you say because you're the one that can get fired, not me. I don't know if you remember hearing that or not, but I mean, I didn't work for Vince, so hell, he wasn't going to fire me because I didn't work for him, and Michael worked for him. So it's just a little side comment I made that, you could say whatever you want because I'm not going to get fired. I'm leaving here tonight, and I'm going to carry on. But getting back to the promoters, numbering them one to whatever the rest, I mean, I understand their position and what they had to do. They were promoters, and they were promoters in a field that was loosely regulated, being wrestling. And the respectful reply is, you know, they did what promoters do. You know, I mean, that's just what they do. You know, they, and you say, well, what do you mean that's what they do? Well, they're greedy and they're thieves. That's every one of them, you know, every one of them. None of them did a straight payday. None of them ever paid the talent like they needed to. None of them ever really medically took care of guys that got injured or stuff like that. I mean, they would pretend like they would, or they would give them a little something. But I mean, if you broke your arm or threw out your back and had to crawl to your front door and ring the doorbell so your wife could come and open the door so you could crawl in the house because your back's so bent out of shape and pinched nerves and stuff like that. I mean, you can start down south. That's a, you know, start with down south, you know, I mean, Eddie Graham, you know, then work your way up to Jim Barnett and whoever that other guy that run Georgia, I forgot his name. It doesn't really matter either. And then, you know, then you got the Fullers and all, I mean, all of them, Crockett, every single one of them. I mean, the wrestlers got the bad end of the deal, and it's just too bad. But I always compared wrestlers to pirates because it was like working with pirates. And what, and the reason I say that is because pirates only care about one thing, and that's them. And every pirate cares about himself. So if you're another pirate, you probably don't want to depend on that pirate to, like, throw you a rope. Especially if there's only one, or if there's one little boat, if you can't expect him to probably come back and get you if you're drowning. So, you know, and that's my only negative thing. And I don't like to go there too much because I'm not a negative person. I don't. And my dad told me, if you don't have nothing nice to say, don't say it. So really, I shouldn't have said anything about promoters because I really don't have anything nice to say about them. I think they, like I said, I'll repeat it. They were greedy and they never give a good payoff. They never paid. I mean, they never paid what they should have paid. I think my pay, I'll give you an example. My payoff at Texas Stadium when we sold it out, May the 4th, 1984, with Sunshine and me and the girls doing that mixed tag match, and I talked to Michael and the birds working and all that. I think it was $3,500 a piece. You know, I mean, what, are you kidding me? Yeah, that was a huge, there was a huge amount of money drawn there. Not to mention sold out everywhere else. I mean, we made so much money for the Von Erich, you know, dad and family and stuff like that. Which, I mean, so that's no big surprise. I mean, that's not like somebody would say, "Man, you're kidding." They were really like that. I thought they helped you guys out with medical or if you needed, you know, to give you good payoffs. No, man, they didn't. As long as they got their stuff. I mean, Lee Fields came into me one night. I had a riot in Meridian, Mississippi. I think I told you about that, didn't I? I may have mentioned it, where he came in and said, "Here's $20 and here's $5 for the riot." And I'm laying there beat to hell and with my hair yanked out of my skull right down to the flesh. And he gave me $5, you know, for the fight. I mean, that's, you know, that's like, you know, that's just crazy shit, you know?
I think so probably the listeners of the podcast probably remember more you being sexually violated by the bear.
Oh, yeah. Well, you never can get that out of your mind. I mean, I think that might be my, what do they say that? What is, you know, what is your legacy?
Your legacy. Yeah.
Yeah. My legacy is having an 8-inch tongue from my hair that felt like 22 sandpaper up my arse. I mean, yeah. In front of a bunch of rednecks in Bowling Green, Kentucky, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes. I mean, yeah, that happened. Yeah. Hell, I was 19 years old. I'm 67 now, and I still don't get near bears. I'm scarred for life.
As Jeff just said, that actually got a lot of play in our Facebook group. People were commenting on that. So in knowing your feelings on promoters, and you're not the only person that we've ever heard ever say that, and obviously you being in the ranks for so many years, who would be the best promoter that you ever worked for, not from a guy with original viewpoints or ideas, but as far as payoffs, who was the most fair to you?
Oh my gosh. None of them.
Got it.
I don't have a real decent word to say about any of them. You know, they. I don't. And I hope I speak for, like you said, you know, I'm not the only one saying this. I mean, there was guys out there, man. They had children. They were. I mean, they were at my time. You know, I didn't have any kids, or you know, I had a wife. But at the same time, they were guys with a wife and three kids or four kids, and you know, they would, you know, they depended on that. You know, they would draw money. You know, and shit. I mean, guys like Nick Gulas and Jerry Jarrett, and my gosh, you know, outright Bonnie and Clyde type stuff. You know, I mean, wow, man. No, none of them. They didn't care. They wanted their job was to make money for themselves, and they did. So they did a good job for themselves. That's good. I'm not mad at any of them. I don't usually waste time even talking about them, you know, but I do for the one reason is because you asked me, and the other is because I always want to tell the truth. And there wasn't one, none of them. And I was, you know, quarter of a century almost in the business. If I don't know it, like somebody would say, hey, you ever heard of so-and-so? If I haven't heard of you, then you didn't, nobody else heard of you either, because I knew everybody.
Jim, let me ask you, now moving south here as you got into your Crockett days or began the Crockett days, and I'll tell you a quick story and share with the listeners. When you left the AWA and you came down to Crockett, I think the first program you were in was with Wahoo. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, I don't know if you were actually taking care of an injury before you started or it was just part of the program, but you were sending in interviews to start your program with Wahoo, but you hadn't actually, you know, shown up on TV and met him in the ring yet. And my old friend Jeff Steele called me up and said, you know what? Jim Garvin is a great heel because he hasn't even looked across the ring at Wahoo and he already has people pissed off at him in the program. So tell me what you remember about your program with Wahoo.
I think that it was a really fantastic program. I think it was held down like most of the stuff, you know, whenever Dusty was around, if you got anywhere near, you know, but that was the Dusty and the Four Horsemen days. And of course you had Flair, which, you know, that's just a whole nother story in itself, but the angle, and I'm not sour over it. That's showbiz. But Wahoo and I had a great angle because I did some unusually great promos, if I may say so myself, as far as talking about Wahoo's mama and about him being a papoose and you know, his mama calling me and crying on the phone and I could hardly understand her. And I mean, I went personal with it. You know, I talked all kind of shit about Wahoo. I mean, I did. I busted loose with some tins on him as far as promos go and made up stories about his mama, tell his mama to quit calling my house or something and, you know, don't hurt her boy and all this stuff. And that was the stuff that the people were mad before we even got in the ring together. And working with Wahoo, holy smokes, there's another man that with I have the highest regard and respect for. Great talent, just a super worker for his gimmick, which really wasn't a gimmick. He was a tough son of a gun. I mean, he was as tough as they come to some degree, you know, in the fact that if he wanted to hurt you, he'd hurt you and he'd hurt you bad, but he never did. You know, I mean, his chops were famous for drawing blood, which they did, but you know, that's just the way, that's the way he worked, and that was good. He was terrific. I mean, him and I had some great Indian strap matches and, you know, promos and stuff like that. I had a good time working with him. Now, you remember too, and you might bring it up, the next angle was with Terry Allen.
Yeah, that was right before his accident, correct?
Yep, I was the last one that he wrestled in Greenville, South Carolina, the night of his accident. Him and I were starting the program, and I don't think I mentioned it to you guys, but we were going to duplicate to some degree what Chris Adams and I did in Texas, and we were getting ready to get into a big angle that was inevitably going to be held down or watered down by Dusty and Flair because, you know, that's just the way that was. And a lot of that was, you know, a lot of that was done, you know, I mean, I don't blame him too much, but I, you know, I do understand how it works. But the fact of the matter is, they knew that I didn't care. Like, I didn't care who they, I didn't care. I did my own thing. I was like an outlaw, you know what I mean? I knew that I could draw money, and I knew that I had certain things going, and I didn't kiss nobody's butt. I wasn't a stooge, and I wasn't an ass kisser. And that kind of made, that kind of would piss them off. Excuse my language, but, you know, it's okay. I mean, it might get, makes my point. And, like, I never, I didn't care if Dusty was the, you know, the king of England. I could care less. And I didn't, and I wasn't going to kiss his ass to get, you know, any spots. It is what it is. Here I am. Make it happen. You know, give me the, my opponent and let me go to work. And that's what I did with Wahoo. And that's what I was going to do with, Terry Allen. We knew it already. It was like the Kevin Sullivan angle, you know, with that him and I had in Atlanta, all over WCW, or NWA at the time. Shit, I mean, you know, that was all. I watched a piece the other day or something where when Rick was trying to, you know, get that. Remember the film where Rick was trying to make the move on Patty?
And, yeah, I was just getting ready. I was getting ready to get to that whole program in a second. But go ahead.
Well, I just, you know, I just didn't, you know, give me who I'm working with and let me do my thing. And then I would do it. And, you know, then it would start getting, you know, then I'd kind of shoot on the promos too. You know, like I'd kind of say stuff, kind of let them know, you know, that Flair was a stooge and had his nose up Crockett and Dusty's ass so far he couldn't breathe. But, you know, along with a lot of others, but. That wasn't the way I worked, and that didn't set well with him, you know. But I didn't care, and I did what I wanted to do, and that was it. And that probably cost me a few million, but I still don't care. And if they was to tell me, I will give you the $2 million if you do it, I'd say no, keep it. I'm not interested. So you want me to talk about the Flair thing?
Well, Barry, do you have a question, real quick?
No, I don't. Actually, when Jimmy gets on a roll, it's like I just want to sit back, pop a can of beer, and I just want to be educated. So please, floor is all yours.
Let me know. So, I mean, I got several examples, and I don't think I've told Jim before. I don't want to repeat myself, but you know, Kevin Sullivan busted that block on my leg. I think I told you guys about that. Did I?
Yes.
Okay, so we had a big, and Kevin Sullivan, to this day, I saw him a couple of months ago at an event, and he said, you know, Jimmy, he says, we were screwed. And I says, yep, we sure were, because, you know, we had that Tower of Doom in Baltimore. I think I told you guys that too, right? Where they,
correct, yes.
Dusty, you did. Just, you know, and it just put the whole card in there. I mean, so that was that. And then, you know, the deal with Terry was going to be huge. And it would eventually got watered down and Dusty would have injected himself. And but I think I was going to the part that when Flair had come out and messed with Patty, give her that fur coat and all that stuff. And then I came on and cut a promo and I was talking about Flair and I was kind of shooting a little bit about, you know, the chances of him picking up Patty and all this stuff and, you know, calling his number. And then so I think they were in the control room and I pissed them off a little bit because I was kind of shooting. But with my personality, the way it was and the way I did my interviews, you never really knew, you know, if maybe he's, you know, shooting or maybe he's working, you know. But anyway, they all emptied out of the control room, Flair, Dusty, the Four Horsemen, and they all came out and injected themselves and told Flair, you know, that if to get away from me and get away from Precious, basically. And Dusty said, asked Flair, he says, Flair, did you give her that fur coat? And Flair says, yes. He says, okay, well then, he said, Precious, you leave with the fur coat. And then he looked over at me, he says, Jimmy, get her out of here. And then, of course, okay, we'll leave. Whatever. I didn't need anybody else to stand up for me. But, of course, they seen a moment that they could jump a ride, and they took it, you know. So they moved me from the fireplace, you know, sitting by the fireplace, from the fire that I built so nice, and they sat all around it. So that happened a lot, you know, but especially with those two gentlemen or those two people that I talk about, you know, Flair and Dusty type of thing. So
let me ask you real quick, you know, you before you got to that thing with Flair and Precious and you, one thing I wanted to get at was when you originally turned, It was the program where you came in and saved Ronnie from Jimmy and the Midnights. What are your memories of that angle and that whole program?
Well, that was okay. I mean, it wasn't one of my biggest, greatest things as far as looking back on, because Ronnie and I weren't that close. I mean, it was obvious to him and I, and if we did work together, it's just only because we had to, type of thing. So that was okay. I mean, I just did it, you know, just to kind of do it. I wasn't a big fan of that program anyway, you know, because when WCW sold, NWA sold, and Turner and all that stuff. And remember Crockett? I don't remember how it went, but they kind of started over again with their building their territory. I think when it went from NWA to WCW, maybe that's what it was when Turner bought it.
Sure.
That year that Turner bought, what did he buy, NWA or something?
Yeah.
And then it was Turner against Vince. Well, and then Jim Barnett was involved in the process. And I had done, and it's okay, you know, I understand how the business works, like I said before, but what had happened was Dusty and Flair and that group there, I guess, I wasn't in the room, so I don't know exactly, but this is what they had a big meeting in Atlanta. And what they had done is they invited certain talent that was going to go to WCW. Well, I had, you know, had the angle with Wahoo and Carolinas. I was had the angle with getting ready to go with Magnum and all this kind of stuff. And I was, money-wise, I wasn't losing them no money. If anything, I was making them money. And they didn't pick me to go to WCW. That was like in the early 90s or something. Or was that early, late 80s? It was the late 80s. Because I think it was like 89 or something.
It was like a latter part of 88, I think it happened.
Yeah, because it was right after that we did end up going down there or something and doing a little program, and then that was it. I mean, it was like I wasn't invited to the party, so that was fine. I went home and took a year off or something, and then Michael called me and asked me if I wanted to come back, and I did, and that's when Michael and I went back and worked for him, and of course, again, you know, we're too hot to handle, and we didn't care either. You know, Michael, he cared a little more than I did, but I didn't care at all because, you know, I just didn't care. Michael cared a little bit more, but that's the way that worked. But, you know, then we came back and did the tag team together, and then I think that ended that too when that all broke up. I don't remember exactly how they ended all that, but they didn't do us no favors there either. They just put us. You know, they didn't really mess with us too much, other than we had great matches with the Steiners and Dr. Death and, you know, good stuff. You know, Brad Armstrong came aboard for a little while. We messed around. Then we remember we had Little Richard, you know, then we were wearing face paint and makeup and we had the band and all that stuff. We had the band at Center Stage, and they never even promoted it for us. You know, they didn't even spend one second to say, hey, the Fabulous Freebirds or the Bad Street Band's going to be at Center Stage, you know. And so, I mean, they didn't help us, you know. I mean, we were on our own because of the fact that, shit, we did what we wanted to do, you know, just like we did in Texas.
You know, I completely forgot to ask you, Jimmy, speaking of music and videos and stuff, how much fun was it to make the Bad Street video in World Class as you were the ambulance driver, I believe?
Yeah, I was the ambulance driver, ad-libbing whatever, Michael's voice or whatever it was. That was good. I knew Michael was into the music thing and I wasn't. And I told Michael that really he shouldn't be either with a voice like that. But, I mean, he didn't listen. Because, I mean, he's the only guy I know that, you know, we'd go on the road and I swear he'd get up on stage in different bars around the country and, holy crap, he'd start singing, and people loved it. You know, it sounded like shit, but they loved it, and shit, it was wild, especially East St. Louis. I remember one time we went to a bar, me, him, and Terry, and oh my gosh, it was terrible. He just almost fell through the drum set, and I don't know. That was a typical Freebird night, though, kind of, you know. It was. I tell you a funny story that happened in that time period, because it's just one of those funny stories. So we're out at East St. Louis, and that's a rough part of town, and it's a night spot kind of thing that goes all night long. So we're out and we're getting loaded, pretty much. And anyway, we go back, we leave the bar, and I can say this now because my wife's out shopping with my granddaughter, I hope, and she didn't sneak in and listen to me. But anyway, I had a little company, and then I had Michael and Terry, and I was driving. So when I got back to the hotel, and it was the Marriott Airport, St. Louis, right across the street, what I did is I parked the car in the front of the hotel, and Mike and Terry were passed out in the back. So I just shut the door and left them in there with the keys. So, because I was going to go up and be busy upstairs. Well, the Samoans came in from their night out, which they weren't in East St. Louis. They were somewhere else. But they came in like at, I don't know, 3-4 in the morning. And Michael and Terry, they noticed that they were passed out in the back seat of this Lincoln that we had rented or something. Yeah, we had to rent it. We didn't drive there. So they, the two Samoans, Sam and the other one, I can't remember his name, the one that's Rikishi, I guess it is, they took the car. One of them drove the Lincoln, and one of them followed in their car. They never woke up. They took them out to the middle of somewhere in St. Louis and parked them in a parking lot of a mall. And this is in the summertime. Then they rolled up all the windows and shut the door and left them there. Now, then they went back to the hotel and went to bed. Now, Michael and Terry wake up like about 9 in the morning. They come to with the sun beating down, with the windows all rolled up, and they lift up and look, and they don't even know where they're at, except they know they're not at the hotel. They're in the middle of this parking lot in the heat, and it was hot. It was that time of year, because it didn't take long to get hot, especially if you're in there with the windows all rolled up. So I tell you what, that was one of the best ribs the Samoans ever did, I think, to the birds. And so Terry and Michael are trying to drive around and see, because back in those days, there was no like GPS, you know, put it in your phone, GPS, Marriott, you know, airport Marriott, and then drive. They had to figure out how to get to where, they didn't know where they were to start with. And they were hung over really bad, really bad. And now they're having a heat stroke and they're sweating and they don't know where they're at. Well, they came back to the room and buddy, they came in that room and they were mad and they jumped on me. My guest had left and they jumped on me and basically, you know, being like brothers, you know, kind of, they didn't hurt me or break nothing, but they were pissed and they, you know, kicked me around a little bit, which that was okay. You know, I understood. I would have too, but cause I mean, I would not want to have woken up in a parking lot, not knowing where I was at after going to East St. Louis all night long. So that was that story.
I used to live right across from St. Louis, so I'm very familiar with East St. Louis, and I'm very familiar with how hot it gets in St. Louis in the summer. So I definitely can empathize.
Yeah, that was a good rib there. But anyway, I ventured off on a little story, but I don't know. I forgot where we were now.
That was a great story. So that's why Jeff and I, we try to stay out of your way. So one of the guys that was part of your group when you were in the Freebirds in WCW was Sir Oliver Humperdinck. I think they were calling him Big Daddy Dink at that time. And having grown up in the state of Florida, Humperdinck, first off, fantastic guy, fantastic human being, one of my favorite people ever I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with. But give me some of your memories of Sir Oliver Humperdinck. Just like I said, great guy, but as a heat magnet in Florida, he was public enemy number one for several years. He had this great run as his heel manager. What do you remember about being able to work with him in WCW?
He was a great guy too. Great personality. And I agree with everything you said about him. There's no doubt about it. Wonderful person. And always was a friend of mine from the very beginning. And the thing I remember when you mentioned his name is Michael and I was driving and we had Big Daddy in the back, and he'd like to sit in the middle because that way he could see out the window. So he's sitting in the middle, and we're all smoking and carrying on. And every time he'd go to light up his thing, his smoke, we'd just take the car and swerve it either left or right, and then he would tip over in the seat. And because he was a good sized guy, but he was top heavy too. So it was funny because we would jerk the wheel to the left, and man, away he'd go all the way down, laying down in the, because he'd just go with the momentum. And he's trying to, and he'd sit back up and say, "Oh, guys, cut that shit out. I'm trying to light this up." We'd say, okay, we won't do it again. He'd sit up and he'd go to strike it again, and we'd cut to the right. And we'd cut to the right. He'd fall over down the left, back and forth. We did that with him for a few miles and had a lot of fun with him. I just remember that one instance where, you know, it was like when Dallas Page was with us for a while, and we're driving, and Dallas takes his shoes off and props his feet up in the on the armrest in the front seat. And Michael and I are up there, and we look down there and see that. And we thought, no, this ain't going to happen. So we took our lighter and both of us and caught his socks on fire when he was sleeping. Because you don't put your feet up there between us like that. So, you know, little jokes like that we'd do to Dallas. And, you know, it'd be funny.
Well, speaking of ribs, I think after we got done recording for part two, you shared a story with us that was, I thought was really great stuff. About a night that Terry Gordy and you and Sid Vicious were at a bar. Could you share that story with us?
Yeah, I sure can. We're at a bar drinking at one of the big top real high tables, you know, where you just kind of stand and lean on it with your elbows, a little round like cocktail table. We're just having a few beers, and I didn't even know anything was going on. And then Sid's like got this funny look on his face, like what, like something's happening, you know? And then, you know, he like looks down, and what had happened is Terry pulled out his junk and underneath the table, we were standing there in the middle of this nightclub, and peed all down his leg. And I mean, when Terry peed, I mean, he peed like a racehorse, you know? So he had pee in his shoes, he had his socks, his pants, everything. He was just soaking wet. He got peed on. Of course, we peed on about everything and everybody we could. Anyway, that was just a Freebird thing. But Sid got peed on that night. Yeah, he didn't do nothing about it either. Good thing on his part, because we were all together. He wouldn't have made it very long.
But. Yeah, absolutely too. So I put a question, and I mentioned that we are recording with Jimmy Garvin right now on our Facebook group. And Jeff, I don't know if you've had the chance to see it, but I put this up 11 minutes ago, and there's about 40 questions already. So I thought I was going to pick a couple out here, and Jeff, maybe you can take a look and see.
Oh, sure. I'm fine.
Yeah. Ahead. Our old friend Richard Singer, Jimmy, checking in, and I'm going to change the verbiage a little bit, but who gets more women, wrestlers or pilots?
Wrestlers. Absolutely. There's really no groupies for pilots.
That seems like that's a mistake too. That pilots should have groupies. Jeff, do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know, because they got a business to take care of the next day, so they can't be out, you know, when all the action's hitting, you know.
That's true. And then our old friend Aaron Minek, and this just goes along with it. Have you ever had any close calls as a pilot? And then somebody checked in right underneath and said, or close calls as a passenger.
No, I was pretty lucky. You know, I never really had any engine failures that weren't induced, you know, on purpose during training or something like that. But no, other than most everything, we had a decompression over Florida one time at 35,000 feet. That'd probably be the closest I came to. And that wasn't a big deal. Just put on, everybody put on their mask and then descend down to 10,000 feet as quick as you can, you know, and let the center know that you've just had a rapid decompression and, you know, you're going to point it down to get down to good air. But that wasn't too bad.
Okay. Jim, MD Tyler has a question. What is the craziest bar fight that you have witnessed or maybe been involved in? And who was the biggest cheapskate that you ever rode with?
Okay, bar fights, none, because nobody would. No, there was no bar fights. There was too many of us. You know, Michael, Terry, Buddy, myself, Nah, they wouldn't. Nobody. It didn't matter. You know, we never got in any bar fights. Never did. Now, you know, Michael had a little incident that he told at the Hall of Fame with some motorcycle gang kind of thing. But other than that, nothing. No big bar fights. Not at all. Because that would we just didn't. It never went that far. Luckily, people had better sense than to pick on us because it just wasn't the thing to do. Smart thing to do anyway.
Because biggest cheapskate.
Biggest cheapskate. If you asked Michael and Terry and Buddy, they'd say it was me, but that wouldn't be true. But they called it, my nickname was like Gimme Jimmy. That's what Buddy called me. Gimme Jimmy. Because I was always messing around looking for a deal. You know, I was always the one that would, you know, if somebody said the room was this much, I'd say, well, come on, you know, whatever, you know. No, the biggest cheapskate, I don't know, because there's a few out there, but none that really, I heard Poffo, the old man with Angelo, was pretty cheap, but I don't know that for sure. And I really don't know that for sure, but it was just a rumor. But I don't know. I don't really know any right off the top of my head. You know, we stuck to ourselves a lot too. You know, we didn't chum around with too many people.
And Angelo Poffo's nickname and a character that he played, one of his gimmicks was called the Miser. So I think it was a shoot. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would probably be a shoot. Yeah. Yeah,
it would. So Michael Herrick is checking in, and I don't remember this at all, but it says your WWF tryout in 1992 to come in as a commentator, or were you going to be working in the ring?
I wasn't sure. And I just actually saw that the other day when I was searching through, because I had never really seen it before, believe it or not. I never saw it before. And I think I was coming in I was kind of insulted because they wanted me to come in for a tryout. And I remember Joe Scarpa, you know, was the one that was kind of heading the boat on that. And I was insulted to the fact that, I mean, I've been in the business and came out of Texas and did all this kind of stuff. And you're telling me you want me to come in for a tryout? You know, that's like calling Leonardo DiCaprio or somebody like that and saying, hey, we want to come in and have you read for this part. You know, we might can use you. Shit, man. What are you talking about, Willis? You know? So I went in there. I saw it. I cut a promo. And then I was sitting in the hallway in a chair. I'll never forget it. And Vince walked by. And I didn't say nothing to him because I didn't know him that well. And I didn't have anything to say to him. So I didn't say nothing. And he didn't say nothing to me. So again, it wasn't one of those things where I stood up and said, you know, Mr. McMahon, my name's Jimmy Garvin. I just want to, you know, say hi to you and tell you how great you are and, you know, what I think of the WWF. Not bullshit. I wasn't kissing his ass either. So you don't want to talk to me? Don't talk to me. I don't need to talk to you either. You give me the chance. You open the door and let me come in, and then let me come in and do my work. And more than likely, you'll be pleased, you know?
Paul Stewart wanted to know, did you ever work Japan?
Yeah, I was over there twice, once with Patty, and I tell you, I really should have did better with her. I missed the boat on that. That was one that cost me a lot of money, because they didn't have no valets over there, and Patty and I went over there, and I just didn't give a crap. And, you know, I just wasn't on my A game like I should have been. That was in 85 or right towards the end after Dallas. We went over there because I remember Ken Mantell helped set it up. But I really passed a gold mine. I really should have had Patty slap Baba in the head, in the face, and then kick him in the nuts, you know, or something like that. Because then we would have became very big heels in Japan, you know, especially the way they regard women and have them, you know, they're subservient type figures. And to have Patty, you know, slap Baba, or Inoki, either one, whichever office I chose, we could have just had we'd have had a hell of a run if I could have just been smart enough. But at the time, I just, once again, that's where it kind of came back and bit me. I probably should have played the game a little bit, and I probably should have took advantage, even though it's water under the bridge, a huge opportunity, millions of dollars lost probably with the angles over there. But yeah, we did go twice, and we had a great time. In fact, remember I told you the story when Harley called me the night in the hotel? I told you that story?
I believe so.
Yeah. Because we, you know, I think I told you that story where we had to leave the next morning and go to Kansas City or St. Louis or something. But yeah, Japan twice. I've been to Australia, Africa, Ireland, England.
Gotcha. So Patrick Dolan's checking in. Patrick, I believe, coming in from the Titusville, Florida area, and wants to know, so you had a figurine put out by Remco. Was that financially positive for you? Did you do well with that?
Yeah. That worked out good. You know, they always got paid pretty good for that one. Yep. That anytime they came out with a figure like that, I was okay.
So, okay, Jim. So next question. Here is a question I like to ask the boys. And since I think I know what your answer would have been, what I'm going to ask you to do is I'm going to ask you to take Terry and Michael and Buddy out of the equation on this. Okay. You're out with the boys at an establishment where maybe some adult beverages are being consumed. And shockingly, Michael, Buddy, and Terry are not with you. Right. So you've got a crowd of people who recognizes you and wants to start some trouble. Tell me two guys, other than your brothers, the Freebirds, that you're going to want standing next to you to help you take care of this situation.
Well, if I ever had a situation like that, which I never did, but if I did, you know, Terry Gordy would be a good one. But you say if I can't pick them, who would it be? It'd probably be like Steve Williams would be nice to have around, because he was definitely could be dangerous. And I guess if I was just thinking of people that could really do damage, you know, Danny Hodge probably would do pretty much a lot of damage too. Those two people, you know, Dr. Death and Danny Hodge, I'd put my money on them every time.
Okay, fair answer.
Yeah, absolutely, too. So I'm going to take you outside the box of professional wrestling for a little bit. So you and I are going to hang out, and you're going to either show me your favorite movie or favorite television show. What am I going to be seeing?
A bottle of Jack Daniels and a joint.
I remember that movie.
Yeah, all right. Jimmy, if you will just text me your address, I'll be right over. Yeah.
Because I'm not a big movie guy or TV guy, you know. And to be honest with you, I drank so much with the birds, I can't drink no more of Jack Daniels. But we'd do something fun. It'd be something fun. We wouldn't sit and watch a movie, though, or nothing. We'd do something.
All right. Well, then let me take it to the next level. So I've got you. I've got the plane gassed up. We're going to one restaurant. You've wrestled all over the world. Since you were a kid. What is the one restaurant that if I said, Jimmy, where should we go? You'd say this is the place.
Okay. Burns Steakhouse in Tampa would be for steak. And then Bricado's has been in Tampa since 1947 or 48. And they have the best Cuban sandwiches and the best devil crabs and stuffed potatoes on the earth. So that would be a good spot. Let me think. Oh, Burns, it's hard to beat Burns for steak.
And I was just going to say, so you just got back from Tampa earlier this week. Did you go to Burns while you were down there?
No, because I didn't bring the proper clothes. It's more of a formal place.
Yep.
And I just didn't bring the right clothes to wear there. But that is a really nice place. They've opened up a place next door that's a little lighter on the wardrobe as far as it's not as fancy. But Burns is definitely a hot spot. And that Bricado's is definitely a hot spot, you know. Tampa's got good food. They got good restaurants.
As we kind of start wrapping up here, a lot of people don't know, you know, I'm sure it's gotten around that you, after your career as a wrestler, became a pilot and very successful. But you also had a connection with someone, dare I say, in the world of high finance. Can you tell folks about your travels with Warren Buffett?
Well, you know, I never met him personally. I flew his wife and his family, and they're wonderful people, very down to earth. He lives in the same house he's been living in for years, drove the same car for the longest time. He finally bought a new one about 10 years ago or something, and he's probably still driving the same one. Real down-to-earth people. In fact, the son brought his own lunch on board in a brown paper bag. Sure did. That was kind of amazing that he brought his own stuff.
How did you get introduced, or how did they find out about you as a pilot?
Well, I was flying for Midway, and then Midway went bankrupt again. And then I had a friend of mine that was flying for Warren, and he said, Jim, send me your paper, and I'll put it in. And I sent him, you know, my resume and stuff, and I got called for an interview I interviewed actually on September 11th, 2001, and then I started September 21st, 2001. So kind of a historic day that I had to start. I mean, I had the interview with the people and got in that way. Wonderful company, great concept, just a fabulous company to work for. A fabulous company. And Bruce Springsteen, when I flew him, he had his own bowl of cereal. He pulled that out of his briefcase and had cereal in his own with his own cup, bowl, and spoon.
So what did Bruce go with? Did he go with the Frosted Flakes or something healthy?
I think I don't really remember looking at it too close. I can't remember, I tell you the truth. I know he cleaned it up and put it back in his briefcase when he left. He was taking his son down to space camp in Alabama or something like that.
But, yeah, and I think it is. I think it's in Alabama. So, Jimmy, we are going to start to wrap up. So looking back at your career, and again, it's I think for us, we knew prior to the interview that you had started off really young, but it seems like you have been in every territory. You had worked for every promotion. You've been all over. If I was to say to you, what's the one thing in your career that maybe you're most proud of or you were most excited about, what would that one thing be?
Well, I really enjoyed working in Florida. I really enjoyed working at home. So I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the atmosphere. Texas was a great financial landmark as far as the enormous business we did there as a unit. You know, so Texas stands out. Florida and Texas stand out to me a lot. And just my whole career was blessed in every way, you know, and I was very fortunate to have experienced it and then fall into my flying career and I actually flew longer than I wrestled. I always wanted to, my primary job in my mind was I was a professional pilot. The wrestling was just icing on the cake, you know, stuff I can talk to my grandkids and show them movies and stuff like that.
You know, we didn't even get a chance to ask you, how did you get interested in becoming a pilot?
Sam Maneker took me to a show in Oklahoma when I was about 19, and he had a little airplane. I fell in love with aviation and started taking lessons when I was 19 years old. Then I bought my own 401 twin-engine plane when I came to Carolinas and flew that all around the country to the Great American Bashes and took that 401 to Seattle, Los Angeles, everywhere around the country, and logged thousands of hours and got experience and had all my ratings, instructor ratings, and, you know, ATP, and which is airline transport pilot type stuff, and tons of hours. So I had a lot of experience and used to have a lot of fun on the plane too. The guys would get a little rowdy in the back, and all I'd do is put on the oxygen, take them up a few thousand feet. The air would get thin.
So, well, yeah. Listen, Jimmy, on behalf of Barry and our producer, Lou, we can't thank you enough for giving us all this time. You've been very generous with your time, and we certainly do appreciate it. And talking about your career, and I always say I love talking to the guys that had a chance to work in multiple territories, because I always find that that's very interesting. However, before we go, I did want to ask you one thing, and I know Barry is interested. Barry, the former president as a kid of the Rocky Johnson fan club. We just lost Rocky recently. Could you share with myself and Barry some memories of Rocky Johnson?
It was always pleasant to be around, and I can't remember exactly what territories I ran into him at, but it was always a pleasure to be around him. It was in Atlanta, I think, mostly when I ran with him. I think I rented him my house in Atlanta for a while too. So, he was just a great guy, all around great guy, well respected, well versed, carried himself properly, and was respected by everybody. And I have nothing but the highest regard, and have the highest regard for him. That's no doubt. And oh, I just wanted to thank the fans. You know, if without them, I wouldn't have been able to be creative and to do the things I did. The fans mean a lot to me. I still get fan mail, and I still answer as much of it as I can. Now with Google Earth, I guess they visit my house all the time. I'm not sure, but I just have much gratefulness for the fans. You know, just thank them, you know, And I wish I was able to entertain him to this day, but I can't run as fast or jump as high anymore, but I sure remember all of them and their support. So I just would like all of them to know that it doesn't go unnoticed or unappreciated by me. And that's a fact.
Well, Barry, anything last for Jimmy?
No, just looking forward to, rumor is you will be in Tampa during WrestleMania. So I look forward to getting to meet you in person. And thanks so much for basically spending, the last 3 weeks with us, Jimmy.
It was my pleasure, guys. And I'll look you up in Tampa when I get down there and we'll see what happens and go from there. But thank all of you for allowing me the time to tell my stories and just take care and keep in touch with me.
Jimmy, before you leave, can I ask you one last question? This will be our wrap-up question.
Okay.
So you look back on your career, 15, 20 years. Who's the one guy you sit there and you think back and you go, Jeff, now that you've asked me this question, who was the biggest asshole you ever met in wrestling?
Bill Watts was a good one. Dusty Rhodes was a good one. Flair was a good one. There's a few of them out there that just, could care less if they was around them or not. But those are three top names I can think of right off the bat.
So, that's a fair go home. So with that,
that's just my opinion.
No, that's why we ask. So listen, once again, Jim, thanks so much for all your time. You've been very courteous. We do appreciate it. On behalf of Barry, myself, and Lou, we really want to thank you a lot.
All right, guys. Stay in touch with me, guys. And I'll hopefully see you in April.
Okay. Have a good one, buddy.
Much appreciated. Take care,
guys. Thanks,
Jim.
All right, guys. Bye now.
Okay. So, Barry, again, as you said, I think we set a new bar for interviews because Jimmy was so good. And, as we started off, just to let you people know, in the very first part, I texted Barry and I said, good Lord, this is going to probably turn into a part two because we haven't even touched upon some stuff and this interview is going so well. And then we got to part two and we started it and he really started telling some great stories. And Barry's like, I think we're going to go part three. So we did not plan on this going three parts, but it was so good. And he had so much to tell and so many great stories that we had to turn it into three parts, Barry.
Yeah. So where do we go from here, Jeff? As I asked you before that, when we were talking, where do we go now?
Well, our guest next week is going to be Lou Kippelman discussing his thoughts, views on the audiophile industry. And I don't know, we'll try to pick it up. Lou, are you willing to be a guest next week?
Absolutely. If you don't mind getting in my car and we'll take a trip to East St. Louis and I'll leave you in the middle of nowhere. Because I need
in a parking lot of a shopping center.
Yeah, because really, I need quality anecdotes like those to reach up to the Garvin bar.
See, I thought you were going to go with the Terry Gordy pissing on Sid Vicious's leg, which I thought was pretty good stuff. But
yeah.
So okay, so now Barry, it's time for our match of the week. It's time for us to go. We're going August 13th, 1987. I think that's the correct date. Fayetteville, North Carolina. And we're going the Midnight Express, Stan Lane and Bobby Eaton with Jim Cornette taking on Barry Windham and the gorgeous one, Jimmy Garvin. Of course, this was right after the infamous and famous angle. I can't believe it. Ricky Morton shouting that into the microphone as they're carrying Ronnie Garvin away after Jimmy had burned him. A really, really solid angle. Barry, I know you remember that.
I do remember that too. And so a couple of things as we go into this match and that was an interesting angle too. So knowing what we know that Ronnie Garvin had been severely burned, Jimmy might seem a little too happy during this match, or maybe there's a reason Jimmy's happy because he's a baby face, gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. He's smiling. He's got that bounce in his step. Precious is out there. So, but again, maybe there was part of him was like, a flame to the face of Ronnie Garvin, not so bad. So, right. Speculation on my part. What do I know?
Only speculation. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. We can say that too. So let me, I have some notes on this match, but it's not really about this match. And I'm going to tell you why. This is a good match. This is not a great match by any means. This is almost a match that was filler and it's not going to go anywhere. It doesn't mean much. The work is solid by everybody here, but there's no crazy high spot. There's no moment when you're going to go, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. I think
and I certainly want, I think the real star is J.J. Dillon on commentary, which we can talk about. I don't remember J.J. Dillon doing much commentary, but someone has clearly, in hindsight, 32 years later, I can say it, or 33 years later, somebody fucked up, because J.J. was gold with some of the shit he was pulling out here. So I think really, if anything, this is more a commentary on the participants in this match, Jeff. So I have a bunch of questions I'm going to ask you, because, again, I think the match is good. There's zero wrong with it, but I can't tell you, you know, other than Barry Windham's bumps, maybe, which I thought were fantastic. And I can't tell you much else that really happened. But so you've got a babyface Barry Windham and Jimmy Garvin. So which was better for these two guys? Were they better as heels, better as baby faces? Was one better than the other, Jeff? Where does it go into your with your opinion on that?
Well, I've stated many times that Barry Windham's one of my favorites of all time. So, of course, I'm going to, you know, as much as we appreciate Jimmy doing the interview, I thought Barry was a better as a heel, you know, okay, especially his turn. I mean, you could see Barry Windham at the beginning of this match. He looked like a future world champion. I mean, I don't think there's any shame in saying that. The the problem when you have a guy that was so over as a heel like Jimmy was, one of the things, I'll give you an example. When Michael Hayes, who is so great as a heel, when he turned babyface, one of the things that Michael started doing, that it was an obvious sort of trick to get the fans, was the foot stomping, okay? And the foot stomping just got to be kind of like, oh, my God, he's stomping the feet again. And that's kind of an obvious babyface tactic. I mean, Robert Gibson used to do it in 1,000 matches of the Rock and Roll Express. And so Jimmy was just like he was trying a little too hard to be a babyface here, you know? Now, that being said, the stuff with he and Precious outside the ring when they did the slap on Stan Lane, yep, in this match, the stuff with Precious and Jimmy Garvin, you know, she punched me. That was hilarious. I mean, you know, there was this, the first thing I thought of when I watched this match was Lou, when we had Lou and invited him to review the match last week, he said the match last week was a great traditional Southern style tag team match. And that's really, this is like fits the template of a Southern style tag team match. You know, you had the manager ringside getting heat. You had, you know, the working on the one baby face, the other baby face comes in, gets the hot tag and clears the ring. And, you know, there was lots of things right about this match. Again, was it a perfect tag team match? No. I mean, you know, this was not any sort of epic, going to be in the top 100 of the decade kind of stuff. But there was, as you said, there was nothing wrong with this match either.
Yeah, there really isn't too. I think there are two things here. I think Wyndham's work, which looks flawless to me, I don't see anything. And then JJ's commentary. So to get back to that question that I asked you too, Jimmy Garvin as a heel was as gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. I liked the young upstart Jimmy Garvin we saw in Florida, but when he became gorgeous, that didn't translate to being a baby face, at least in my eyes. I that was definitely a heel type of gimmick that I just felt worked. Barry Windham, though, is a tough one. I'm going to say I actually preferred Barry more as a baby face, but that doesn't mean anything with that, because I feel he was dead. So the next part of that question, Jeff, and you and I have said, look, we think Barry Windham is one of the greats of all time. But taking our personal opinions out of it, where does Barry Windham rank or rate as far as the all-time grapes? And I all-time grapes. You could tell what I'm eating right now. Delicious grapes.
I think Barry Windham would have been ranked far higher if he had come along 5 years before he did, because when Barry Windham really hit his stride, especially as a heel, to where he could have been the face of a company, there was the transition into corporate, you know, ownership of wrestling companies, which, you know, he was a mulligan. He wasn't a corporate kind of guy, but, right, you know, I think if Crockett had not completely fucked the pooch and had still maintained the ownership of the company, I think Barry would have been a very representative, a world champion of a Southern wrestling company with no problem whatsoever. I think that his certain personal foibles, his tendency to suddenly come up with an injury that was going to have him out for a couple of months, I mean, you can't sit there and say those things didn't affect the way people viewed him, you know, and he would walk out on companies and that's, you know, there was a thought, I think, by some that Barry was not reliable. I can't sit there and tell those people they're 100% wrong. I think it was a little bit overblown, but I don't think it's, you know, 100% inaccurate. And that affects his, you know, when you put the pantheon of great all-time wrestlers, do I think he belongs in a list of all-time great wrestlers? Yes, I do. Is he like in the top three or four? No. And because of those things I mentioned.
Yeah, and I think so. Taking a lot of this stuff that we know, because I think if you weren't connected to the wrestling business, and when I say connected, I mean reading the Observer, getting your information somehow, you would not have known that Barry Windham was just taking time off because he wanted to go out and live his life. But if I was judging him on his in-ring work, and we're looking at a period of probably 5 to 8 years, somewhere in that neighborhood, I would put him in the top 10 guys in the U.S. And that's based off of, I think, what he was able to accomplish, because he was flawless. It was just watching him in the ring. I'm sometimes, you know, his timing literally to the nanosecond is just perfect. Everything is there. But let's get to J.J. Dillon. So J.J. Dillon's on commentary. Now, what was the deal here? What was J.J.? He was with the Horsemen when this was occurring, right?
Yes, I believe so. You know, it's like the way that this, I think this was like a match that was taped to be shown on WCW Superstars. So this was not like part of Worldwide or part of the TBS show, obviously. But so the fact that JJ was on commentary, and you're right, he had a very funny line when Precious started spraying her perfume or whatever around. And he said he started questioning whether or not Jim Garvin and Precious had gone to the building before the matches and had messed with the air conditioning system so that the perfume was coming out of the air conditioning unit, and that's what was affecting Jim Cornette. And that was a very funny line. And Tony was like, "What are you talking about?" Like, and he's like, no, I think he may have come and they may have messed with the circulation of the air conditioning. And that was kind of a cute line, I thought.
I think it's one of the best ever. And he comes up with a whole bunch with that. And the irony with this whole thing was he wasn't really a traditional heel commentator. That's why I was asking if he was with the Horsemen, because this is a completely different view. So they're talking about Bobby Eaton, and JJ comes forth and says, "The thing about Bobby Eaton is he has that kind of blank stare about him. Bobby has one of the highest IQs of any wrestler in the world today. It's up around 156, I think. Borderline genius. You have to talk to him for a little while for that intelligence to come through." Tony then says about a minute later that Bobby is one of the great high flyers. JJ's response? Well, Tony, that's actually logical. High IQ and high flyer, they go together. I mean, come on. It's fucking gold.
That was very funny stuff. You're right. Yeah, no, JJ was definitely pretty stellar on this the commentary role. There's no question about that. The other thing I wanted to point out was the great spot during the match where whether this was planned or it was like a rib they were playing on Jim at ringside, Jackie Crockett with the camera kept bumping into Jim at ringside. Okay. And, you know, Jim, leave me alone. And the bit where Jimmy goes into his pocket and pulls out a wad of bills and offers to pay Jackie Crockett to leave him alone was very, very funny, I thought.
Oh, it was great. And they talk about, I mean, it seemed like first off, the guys in the ring were having fun, but the commentating team, I think, was just having a blast. This was one where they were relaxed. There are these inside jokes and inside references and a lot of nonsense. At the same time, though, the humor and the fun of this really shines through. And they spend about 5 or 6 minutes on Jackie Crockett just talking about it. Really, really funny stuff.
Yeah, so I will post a link to this match up there. As I said, it's a really good match. It's not necessarily great. There's a lot of fun stuff, you know, like with Jimmy at ringside, JJ and Tony on the commentary. Very funny stuff. So Barry, before we wrap up, I know it's a little early, but since you've lock some people in. Do you want to do perhaps a plug for your CWF Fan Fest coming up in, not in Lutz, but in beautiful Tampa, Florida?
Yeah, and we are not in Lutz this time, which is always a little sad because we really do love it there. We love the hotel. We love the whole area, being able to hang out and walk around. But we did have an opportunity to get into the Fort Homer Hester Lee Armory, which is now called the Brian Glazer Family JCC. And this was the facility that Jody Simon, Joe Malenko, had a fundraiser for and was able to get a wall of fame detailing a lot of the history of that building. But we're going to be there for 3 days. We're doing three different shows. The first show is on April the 2nd, which is the Thursday before WrestleMania. And we're going to be doing a Legends Roundtable. It's going to be a 2-hour, maybe 2.5-hour Q&A. It's going to have, I'll announce some of the names. We still are finalizing, I think, two more names, but you're going to have Buddy Colt. You're going to have Bugsy McGraw. Bill Alfonso will be there. Scott McGee will be there. Cuban Assassin will be there. And we've got two other names that hopefully today we're able to actually lock in. The next day is going to be My Dance with the Devil. It is going to be the first ever reunion since, I believe, 1986 of Kevin Sullivan and Maha Singh. So it's our old friend Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob Roop is going to be donning the makeup. He will not be shaving half of his head.
I was going to ask if he was going full gimmick by shaving half the head.
I didn't ask him to do that, but knowing Bob, he's usually pretty good about that stuff. He may, but he will have the makeup on, which is good. And also Snake Master Abudadeen.
Now that's will the key there. Kit for me. That's the key.
That's a big one for you. Yeah.
And Cash Money Dave Pinzer had to open up the checkbook because I know that Abudadeen does not travel unless that check is cleared. That's all I'm going to say.
It which is true. And Dave, we you call him Cash Money. I call him 56K Downloads. That's my new nickname. Yes, exactly.
That's so he will week. Be that's there. That's just half a week. Half a week of episodes. That,
yeah. But Snake Master will also have one of his giant pythons with him. So if
that's
anybody,
not just his arms either, because you know he's a little bigger than he was when he was the Abudadeen in mid-80s.
Actually, he's about twice his size, actually.
He's two Lou Spectres.
Two Lou Spectres. Yeah, but not as sexy, which I think we can all agree on. Yeah, and but he will have his snake. So if you are fearful of snakes, just let us know and we can seat you on the opposite side of the room. But then there'll be a photo opportunity, all three men in gimmick with the snake. And then our big show, which is on the Saturday, Jeff, which we have announced, is Uncle Bob Roop and Ron Fuller in the same building having a debate, discussing the takeover, the destruction of Knoxville, the Plan B video, discussing all of it for about 2 hours, between 2 and 2.5 hours, and then a photo op with both men together.
Uh-oh. I mean,
could you have ever imagined a year ago when Ron was doing the Studcast and talking about Bob and the takeover and then Bob's responses that these two men would actually be in the same building and willing to discuss what went down over 40 years ago? I know I couldn't.
I will give you and Cash Money Pinzer props because I know that negotiations for months have been going on outside of Barry and Dave to have this meet and greet between these two legends of pro wrestling getting together. But you guys came up with, Cash Money Dave Pinzer rolling out the cash, Barry using his political influence to get it down in Tampa at the Fort Homer Hester Lee Armory. And folks, you are not going to want to miss it.
Yeah, it's going to be a big deal, too. And as we've been saying on the posters, and also credit to the artist, Adam Turkel, who is doing, I think, state-of-the-art work for us for these posters. And he is going to have copies of these posters available for purchase that you can get signed and hang wherever you want to hang it. But it's a big deal. I'm really super excited. We will have extra security on hand in case Bob and Ron can't take it and have to get at each other. So, real excited. That'll be on April the 4th at 3:30 p.m. So be there.
And I'm going to say that although it has not been firmed up, confirmed totally, there is a possibility, Barry, I'm going to put this out there, there may be an appearance unpaid by Mrs. Baldwin. She may be joining me.
What?
I'm just gonna say, yes, yes, yes. She will have an autograph table available, you know, to sign her own personal autographs because we've talked about her so much here on the show. So finally, Barry, before we leave, a somewhat sad note that we must share with the listeners. So, folks, I'm sure you know that we recently did a top five road songs, and we did not play for your listening pleasure any clips from the songs themselves because, you know, let's just say that the music industry, Barry, cracking down on the usage of certain songs for copyright violations and stuff. So as you people know, and we've discussed more than once, last week we or maybe it was a week before, we talked about the death of Neil Peart of Rush and, you know, of course, Spirit of Radio has been our intro and exit song for, geez, over almost going on now 2.5 years, Barry. And unfortunately, as of this episode, we will no longer be using Spirit of Radio as our intro and exit. And again, negotiations are ongoing for a new intro and exit song for Breaking Kayfabe with Baldwin and Barry. So we are so appreciative of the response we've gotten for people that aren't even fans of Rush, like Spirit of Radio as our intro and exit song. So, so Barry, as we wrap it up, let's one last time close out the show with Spirit of Radio by Rush. And until next week, when we will talk to you again.
Breaking Kayfabe with Baldwin and Barry is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.